Well, when Joe actually first contacted me about this, he said, what I'm looking for is an expert on fiber and fiber rings. And I thought to myself, well, I don't like Raisin Bran, and fiber rings sounds like a breakfast cereal that may serve at a AARP retreat. So that's why I named it More Fiber in Your Diet. Now, Joe went on to say that, well, he was using fiber kind of as a catch-all for terrestrial systems. And then he went on to say again that, don't worry, he says, we've got a bunch of people here talking about satellite and wireless and all the exciting stuff, and we need somebody to talk about wireline stuff. So I looked up terrestrial in the dictionary, and it tells you it's somewhere relating to the Earth, which, you know, that's okay. And I looked number two, it says it has a worldlier, mundane character, so it may give you an idea of what you can expect here. The other thing, number three, is it's living or growing on land. It's not aquatic, and we certainly learned that during the hurricanes. This stuff does not work well in the water. Now, antonyms for this, cosmic, heavenly, otherworldly, that's the satellite stuff. So you got the mundane stuff here, I'm afraid. So, what we're going to talk, I picked three events that... Everybody has talked about September 11th and the recent hurricanes. The advantage of growing old is that you can go back even farther than most people, and I was there at Hinsdale. So I can talk a little bit about that. Now, here's a list of Illinois Bell, at the time, switching center fires. The first one was in 1929, downtown Chicago. Regardless of how I look or what my kids think, I was not at that one. Next one was 1946, River Grove. I wasn't there either. But 1988, Hinsdale, I was there. And the reason for me showing you these three is to say disasters happen very infrequently. That's why we call them disasters. If they happen all the time, I guess you'd just say, geez, life stinks. And, you know, we have fire after fire, hurricane after hurricane. But, in fact, they happen infrequently, so it's tough to prepare for them. It's tough to, you have one, it's a long time, hopefully, before another one comes along. And so you've got to try to figure out how to be prepared when you're not going to use that for a long time to come. Now, I told you I was in Hinsdale. I'm thinking, okay, how do I establish with you that I really was there? And I had I figured if I could show you a picture of me in action at Hinsdale, that might help establish some credibility. I looked through my files. This is the only one I could find. That's me in the middle going through the chow line. So I don't know what that says about what I did there, but that's the only picture I could find. But I was at Hinsdale. Now, what we learned about Hinsdale here on May 7th, 1988, Hinsdale was in the middle, and this is not an actual engineering diagram, just one I put together, but the squares on the left represent basically suburban offices in the Chicago area. Hinsdale is an affluent community just outside of Chicago. Has about 45,000 lines served out of that switch. The C-numbered boxes are Chicago offices or tandems. And so when you look at this, the logical interconnection, it's a very robust network we had at the time on May 7th. Now, when you look at the physical interconnection that we had on May 7th, this is basically what it looked like. And planner said, boy, we've got this fiber. We can put a lot of stuff in that fiber. And it makes it cheaper to put it through one spot. Now, this was on May 7th. On May 8th, this was the interconnection we had. And at the time, it was probably the biggest wireless network around because all the wires were gone. So that what we learned at Hinsdale, basically lesson learned, was logical diversity is not enough. You have to have physical diversity. One other personal lesson learned that I had is when you leave your young wife alone with two small kids for a month, when you do come home, she's really not impressed with what you did at the fire. So September 11th, that's the next one. Here's a couple things I think, I guess, you know, we all have lessons learned. Here's the couple I learned from there. One is difficulty in maintaining diversity. Any number of companies went so far as to get some of their service from two different carriers or looked for different facilities to ensure diversity. Well, what they discovered is that the fibers may run down the same trench eventually, and when that trench goes, you've lost your diversity. I think as time goes on, we've seen where even things get, when you do fiber grooming, things of that nature, it makes it more efficient, but you may not know that you have diversity all the way from end to end on a lot of things. So that's a very important lesson learned. Second thing we learned is the importance of wireless communications. Radio systems, you know, have interoperability issues, but generally cell phones don't. I know I was in London a year or so ago, saw a policeman there. He had three radios on him. Got talking to him and said, in an emergency, what's the thing you depend on the most? He pulled out his cell phone. He says, because this can always get through. And so cell phones are an important tool for first responders and emergency responders. The importance of text messaging. We talked as part of the NRIC team. We were in New York this summer. We talked to the financial community. And they made a point of saying how important text messaging was to them in the few days right after September 11th. They used that quite a bit. And finally, the importance of wireless in assisting in search and rescue. WERT, or the Wireless Emergency Response Team, it's basically a nonprofit organization made up of volunteers from any number of different companies. It first came together right after September 11th when somebody decided that, you know, there may be people in the rubble that have cell phones that are trying to contact people, but there's no cell towers. So they actually got some folks, put, I'll call them cell sites on their back, if you will, and went up to the rubble trying to get cell phones to register. One of the other things that it helped with, sad to say, is a number of crank calls came in, people reporting that they were in the rubble, they were on a cell phone. This team was able to trace where some of those calls were coming from and determine that they were not in the rubble and prevent some rescuer from risking his life trying to go in to find somebody who was actually not there. So I think that's some of the things learned. This WERT team, like I say, it's a nonprofit volunteer organization, came together also during Katrina. We had flew a number of missions. People with, again, mobile, I'll call them cell sites, went out on the on Coast Guard helicopters looking for people trapped in attics that, you know, may have a cell phone and try to find them that way. So that's what WERT does. Hurricanes. What did we learn? Everything is eventually terrestrial. So it may be mundane, but that's what happens. Wireless is only wireless from the handset to the cell tower. After that, by and large, it travels on fiber or land-based facilities to get back to the MSC and so forth. Now, I heard today about satellite, and you may have some calls, but by and large, everything gets to be terrestrial eventually. So as mundane as it is, that's where it's at. You need power. You've heard that from a number of people. Without power, nothing works. And fuel is a key issue. Most of these cell towers, many of them won't have generators. They'll have batteries that last for a few hours. Even if you drag a portable generator up there, though, you've got to have fuel for it. And one of the things David mentioned, NSTAC and the Interdependency Council of Power and Telecommunications, one of the things we're looking at is to try to put cell towers on a priority during an emergency in that area. How do you get power back to those cell towers in a hurry to keep things going for the for folks like that? And finally, I think one of the things we learned is you can't always design for a worst-case scenario. To design, you know, the damage in New Orleans was unprecedented. To try to design a network that could withstand that kind of attack, you'd be paying $3 and $4 a minute for a call. So you can't always do that. So here's the lessons. Here's the three events that happened. So what do we do with those? I guess the question is, what do you do with lessons? Do we learn? First thing was NSTAC. David mentioned that, and I won't go over it again. He mentioned advise the president, but it's using a lot of the things we've learned and trying to make things better in that respect. The NRSC, or the Network Reliability Steering Committee, this is a group. It's chartered by the FCC, and it's basically an industry group that looks at concerns of the FCC and uses for data reported outages. I think the key thing here is it makes recommendations to the industry by the industry. So the industry looks at things and then recommends how to make them better. They've looked at things such as power, timing and synchronization, DS3 outages. Last thing is NRIC, Network Reliability and Interoperability Council. And what that does is puts together best practices for the industry. I'd like to talk a little bit more about that. it shows it here. It shows it starting in 1992. I think the roots of NRIC were really back probably with the Hinsdale fire. I know after the fire, a number of folks from Illinois Bell were out here in Washington meeting, coming up with recommendations, trying to analyze how to prevent this. Then I want to say in 1991, somewhere in there, there was a big SS-7 outage in the country that disrupted service. Shortly thereafter, they put together NRIC, and they looked at developing best practices. It's a two-year cycle, NRIC is. You can see, and they have a different topic. NRIC 4 was Y2K issues. Obviously, that was before Y2K happened, so they were trying to come up with best practices for that. Packet switching, NRIC 6 was Homeland Security. The last two years been spent with NRIC 7 Emergency Services, looked at things of PSAPs, for instance. Two of the other things too, that I've been involved in, there's been a group that's looked specifically at public data networks, another one that's looked at wireless service and tried to develop best practices for those two. One of the things that's come out of NRIC 7 mentioned a PSAP workshop. Back in November, under the auspices of IEEE, Lucent hosted a PSAP workshop for PSAPs, public safety answering points, to take a look at some of these best practices and see if there'd be a value of applying some of the best practices that have been put together for communication, telecommunications, to apply them to PSAPs to see if we can make it that much more reliable. I think basically as an outcome of that, I think they're going to try to start a group to look at that. The results of that are on a website, a IEEE website, if anybody's interested, I can give that to you. One of the things we do at NRIC, we've broken down basically the communications infrastructure into 8 ingredients. What we found is anything that makes up a communication infrastructure can be defined in one of these 8 ingredients, and that's how we try to analyze things. I think one of the key things we look at is we try to analyze vulnerabilities rather than threats. The difference being a threat is basically a way someone or something has tried to attack your system. So once you've seen that, you try to protect against it. When you look at vulnerabilities, you say, well, I know how the system operates, so what are the things that could damage it, and I'll try to protect against that. Every year, there's advances in science, there's advances in technology, there's advances in terrorism. They always think of new ways to attack your system. And so if you only look at threats, you're doomed to always chasing to experience it and then try to close that hole, and then they'll find another hole. If you look at vulnerabilities, you try to close the hole regardless of the threats, and that prevents somebody from getting in and trying to attack you that way. So that's how NRIC has tried to analyze these things. Now, what's better? Is regulation better, standards, or best practices? Let me talk about the three. First is regulation. It's a slow process. It's a legal process. Sometimes technical expertise can be compromised. And it ends up with mandated behavior. There's oftentimes unintended consequences from regulation. Second thing is standards. It's a competitive process, sometimes influenced by the strongest competitor. It's a little quicker to adjust, and it could be voluntary, and it could be mandated, the result of that kind of operation. Then we've got best practices. It's an expert process. It's based on expertise. It's a fast process, and implementation is voluntary. Now, the key thing here is implementation is voluntary. All the best practices, one of the things that each report says is, These are not requirements. Each company that looks at the best practices has to determine whether or not they should implement the best practice or not based on their company, their specific situation. So you can decide regulation, standards, or best practices. So NRIC best practices, there's currently over 800 best practices that we've documented. I found it interesting. I did a search, and when you go to the NRIC website, you can pick up, you can search by a number of different things. There's 777 best practices of the over 800 that apply to wireline. Wireless, there's 753, and we've just added another 50, so there's roughly 800 that apply to wireless, and there's 849 that apply to satellite. So as glamorous as those things are, and as mundane as wireline is, most of the best practices apply to all three of them. So Key characteristics of best practices: they do not endorse anything that's paid for, no documents, no services, no products. It's vendor agnostic, I guess. It just is good practices. It addresses classes of problems. As I say, it looks at vulnerabilities, not just one problem, but it looks at a whole class of them. I think a key point is that they're already implemented. It's not just somebody's good idea. It's something that some company has implemented, has found useful, has found economical to do, and good ideas we don't use as best practice. They're developed by industry consensus. One company cannot just say, we're going to do this. The group has to do it. And there's sufficient rigor and deliberation. I mean, I know we've sat for hours sometimes debating a couple of words on a best practice to make sure it's right and conveys the right information. The website is there. It looks like vvvvv.nric.org. But that's actually a three W's, .nric.org. And if you go there, you can find a lot of the old, I think all six or all six of the previous NRICs. You can find the best practices and so forth. So, going back to the original theme, what are the characteristics of a high-fiber diet? Well, number one is communications network is highly reliable. Switches operate at 6 nines reliability. By and large, the network is up and working when you want it there. Number two, everything is eventually terrestrial. It's not glamorous, but that's what it all comes down to. That's where we're all at. Number three, we need to keep an eye on diversity. Even if you design diversity into your networks, it's easy to lose that diversity. You've got to keep vigilant on that all the time and stay after that. Four, the industry continues to identify improvements. Through these three groups and any number of other groups, we try to learn from the things that have happened and improve the reliability of the network. And finally, a characteristic of a high-fiber diet, it keeps you regular, which is better than being regulated. Thank you.